Station for public broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lorine. Coming up, we're going to talk about how the tax bill in Washington will affect Medicare, the program that provides medical coverage for billions of Floridians. And we'll talk about how John Morgan's announcement that he will not run for governor next year as a Democrat, how that will affect the other candidates who've already announced they're running for governor in 2018. And we'll hear about a new book that covers the almost 100-year history of broadcasting here in Florida. But first, several listener comments about recent programs. First, a comment about last Tuesday's interview with graduate students at USF who work long hours and are living on poverty wages.
Hi, Ron. I go by the name of Traveling Nurse. I do home health care. I can relate to where these people are. You spend your life working to teach, to shape futures, and I don't think it's right the way they're treated. They should be paid what they're worth. That being said, I've been doing home health nursing for going on 8+ years. I have not seen a raise in my pay in 8 years. The only thing I've seen change is the amount of work. And I don't ever see that getting better as far as getting a raise. It's just never going to happen. So I'm still out here doing it. I'm still looking after people as best as I can because that's what home care nurses do. Another point, why do you let people like Charlie the plumber come on and waste airtime? It just infuriates me when I hear his voice. It's a waste. It's very irritating that you allow him even minimal airtime because he's just an idiot. You can quote me on that.
And we received the following three comments about last Thursday's interview with a Tampa Bay Times reporter, Lane DeGregory, about her profile of a feral child called the girl in the window. And we received two more calls about Friday's interview with health insurance whistleblower Wendell Potter about the Republican tax plan that is ending the health insurance mandate, one of the key parts of the Obamacare ACA health insurance program.
This is Micheline in Lakeland, and I've never heard a sadder story than the one that you just told about that little girl, that by 7 years old, she couldn't talk, she couldn't walk, she couldn't do nothing. This is the worst thing, and I think those people should be sterilized, the parents, and they should be in jail for the rest of their life. This is inhuman, worse than inhuman. This is just unbelievable. I mean, it's one of the best stories. I mean, it's not a good story by any means, but I do my walk every morning, and I heard that, and I could not believe how horrible, horrible that was. Thank you, Rob, for letting us know about things like that. That happened in Plant City, too, which is next door to my town of Lakeland. Thank you, Rob. Keep up the good work in telling us what's going on in this on this planet.
This is Dave Thompson from Sarasota. As always, thank you for the good show. One I caught on Friday, but the one other point I wanted to make was it's good for the people to join Move to Amend that should, this tax care fight and all the laws that the Republicans have tried in the past just made legalized bribery. It's one of the major problems. They can give unlimited amounts of money to bribe the politicians to get what they want. That's why bad things are happening.
Hey, it's Stephen in St. Pete. I was just listening to the show and the interview with Wendell Potter. Very good. Now, when you come to LBJ and JFK, that time period, when LBJ got Medicare approved, there were many, many progressive Republicans that voted with LBJ, not only on the civil rights, but also on Medicare. And, of course, the Goldwater Reformation, the conservatives were already calling Medicare communist insurance, that there'll be death panels and they'll drag you off in the middle of the night to kill you and all this stuff. And just the craziness of the Goldwater Reformation, of neoconservatism. But my question that I would leave to everybody, what is the Democratic Party going to do? Are we still going to have the Nancy Pelosi's and the Evan Bayh's and, you know, that type of philosophy and Charles Schumer, who's a multimillionaire on Wall Street? Yeah, they babble a little bit about some causes and everything. And yeah, that's a bad tax program. But the bottom line is they're paid by Wall Street. Both parties are against national health care. And we have to figure out a champion somewhere among the ranks besides Bernie Sanders and Liz Warren that will stand. Where are the Democrats, where are the people today talking about national health care. It should be on the news every day. Every Democrat should be screaming for it on the top of every mountain, on the top of every rooftop. It should be the dialogue of discussion every day, national health care, that millions of people are dying before their time because of, really, and you might as well use the word, sort of a holocaust by the neoconservatives. They're not putting you into gas chambers, but they're killing you slowly with the pens. They're not letting you go to a doctor when you need to do. They're not letting you go to a dentist when you need to do. They're killing us, the Republican Party. And the Democratic Party is just as guilty. It's just that they lie about it more.
Well, a bunch of listener comments that came in over the past few days. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. This is Radioactivity. Next, we're going to take a look at state and local politics on Florida this week. Coming up next, police have arrested a suspect in the Seminole Heights serial killer case. John Morgan won't run for the Democratic nomination for governor. The AARP warns that the GOP tax plan may hurt Medicare. And Governor Scott wants the power to appoint three new Supreme Court justices on the day he leaves office. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
From the WEDU studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week, our panelists are Chris O'Donnell is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Bill Bunting is a Pasco County GOP state committee man. Rita Ferrandino is the founder and CEO of ARC Capital and a Democrat. And Kathleen McCrory is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you for coming. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Well, the man accused in a string of killings in Tampa's Seminole Heights neighborhood was arrested this week, 51 days after the first murder. Howell Emanuel Donaldson III is being held without bail. He faces four counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Benjamin Mitchell, Monica Hoffa, Anthony Naboa, and Ronald Felton. Donaldson was arrested after police responded to a tip from a McDonald's worker in Ybor City, where the 24-year-old suspect was employed for the past several months. The murders terrorized the multicultural Seminole Heights neighborhood just northeast of downtown Tampa. Chris, there was quite a relief in that neighborhood when this happened, and I think a lot of celebrations in store this weekend because people feel the cloud is lifted.
Oh, for sure. 51 days since the first killing, that neighborhood, which is an up-and-coming neighborhood in Tampa, has really been under a cloud. People afraid to go out. I mean, talked to one guy who gave up his morning bike ride because he was too worried about being shot. So it's huge relief, and you know, law and order is such an important local issue. It's been interesting to see how Mayor Buckhorn and even Governor Scott have kind of got involved in this case.
Politically, does it give a boost to either Mayor Buckhorn or to Governor Scott? Scott came in on the day after the arrest to congratulate the TPD, and Buckhorn was in the neighborhood and giving press conferences throughout this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to make a big deal in the in whatever Governor Scott does next, you know, if he runs for the Senate or not. For Buckhorn, he's obviously term limited, so he's got nothing coming up. But it was interesting to see how people that have positioned themselves to replace Bob Buckhorn did get involved. I saw Jane Castor being interviewed on TV about the case. David Straz donated some reward money, so people definitely saw this as a way to get their name out there.
Kat, I want to ask you, there's a controversy about who gets the reward money. There's been a little bit of reward money given out, but do you think that you get the sense that that controversy is going to linger, or is it going to be resolved pretty quickly?
Well, I think today that they had said that all of the money was going to go to the McDonald's manager who had phoned in the gun.
Right. So that's been decided.
Yes. Yeah, right. That seems to be pretty decided.
Uh-huh. And the relief in the neighborhood, I mean...
It was a scary time for people in the neighborhood. I mean, I know my mother from New York was calling, and I live in St. Pete. So it was something that, you know, got national attention, but I do get the sense that there's a great sense of relief right now.
Mm-hmm. Bill, the police were very secretive about the weapon, and until the murder weapon was recovered, they didn't really talk much about it during these 51 days. Smart police strategy?
Absolutely, because they had to know, they knew the caliber from the bullets that were taken out of the individuals. So when they got a hold of that gun from the manager, as soon as they saw what caliber it was, that put the dots right there, and they dotted it and says, this is it, we've got this guy. But you got to give credit to the Tampa police for running the cars all night, and to Mayor Buckhorn, and to Governor Scott. I mean, not only did he send down the state police, the Florida Highway Patrol, he also sent down FDLE. So they wanted to secure that neighborhood. And I agree with Chris. I don't think it was anybody gains political points. But I think that public service showed a good hand by both parties coming in and serving the people.
Okay. Well, last week, well-known Orlando attorney John Morgan announced that he's not running for Florida governor, at least not as a Democrat.
For months, Morgan has flirted with the possibility of seeking the Democratic nomination for the 2018 race. But the day after Thanksgiving, Morgan tweeted that he could not muster the enthusiasm to run for the nomination. In a video he put out this week, Morgan said he disagrees with both Democrats and Republicans.
Also, over time, I have found myself really looking at the two-party system, the Republicans and the Democrats. And the truth of the matter is, I find myself somewhere in the middle. A lot of my Republican friends will meet with me and they'll say, you know what, John, you're really a Republican. And I'll say, no, I'm really not. What I really am is what I call myself is a compassionate capitalist.
Morgan says he's leaving the Democratic Party, but he did keep open the door to running as an independent. However, he tells an Orlando TV station that his many business enterprises would make such a run difficult. The plaintiff's attorney is enormously wealthy due to the success of his law firm, Morgan & Morgan, and he appears in a steady stream of radio and TV ads for the firm.
So, Rita, any more insight as to why he decided not to run for governor?
Well, I wish John Morgan well, and I think the big winner here was actually Gwen Graham, because his not announcing what he was going to do was really causing a lot of confusion in the Democratic Party primary. Most importantly, people were holding their money. And so we are very happy that he has made his announcement that opens the field. And I think you're going to see that Gwen Graham's fundraising numbers will show the impact of this happening.
And why Gwen Graham as opposed to the other three announced candidates?
Well, I think Andrew Gillum's having trouble getting traction. He's certainly having trouble raising money. I think that you'll see that Phil Levine in Miami, who has certainly got a lot of money, he's run TV ads that are not moving his needle. So I think that from the Democratic perspective, John Morgan's announcement was welcomed, and it's going to pave the way for Gwen Graham.
Okay. Well, Bill, would you agree with that, that this helps Gwen Graham's?
I think it helps Gwen Graham. There's no question about that. I mean, John Morgan, I think, just gets free publicity. This is one ad he doesn't have to take out on television. I mean, that's the way I look at that.
Because we're all talking about it.
That's right. We're talking about it. I think Phil Levine, though, I disagree with Rita on that. I think the amount of money that guy's got to spend and coming from Miami-Dade and being Jewish, I think he's got a pretty good shot.
The reason I will disagree with that is that Gwen Graham is the daughter of Senator and Governor Graham. Right. And he has, in a Democratic primary, there are a lot of people who've grown up with Gwen Graham, who've had Gwen Graham at their home and know her well. And Phil Levine is not very well known and has got almost no name recognition. So the amount of money he'd have to spend to actually play in a Democratic primary may not be worth it for him.
But you don't have a Democratic chairman to help anybody.
So
we will by next week.
So, okay, Rita, you make a good point. But what I wonder, Kat, is that we're entering into this era where millennials and Generation Xers are going to be a bigger part of the voting bloc than ever before and are just about to eclipse baby boomers and senior citizens. So, you know, I understand your point that the Graham family has a lot of history here in Florida, but that's history, I think, largely with baby boomers and with the greatest generation.
I lived in Dade County for 10 years, and I would say the Graham family does still certainly have name recognition. But Gwen Graham doesn't seem to really be exciting the Democratic base in South Florida. I mean, in the way that Charlie Crist failed to excite the Democratic base down in South Florida. She represents North Florida. She's taken some pretty conservative stances. And I think in order to win that block that you're talking about, I think that's going to be a heavy lift for her.
Mm-hmm. John Morgan left open the door, I think it's fair to say, to run as an independent. He didn't say he wasn't going to run. He just said he's leaving the Democratic Party, not going to run as a Democrat.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if he runs as an independent. You know, he's a shrewd businessman. Is he really going to put all those millions of dollars into a race where he might poll single figures?
You know, I was surprised in his announcement, too, where he says he doesn't agree with the Democrats a lot. He doesn't agree with the Republicans. He's right down the middle. But yet, you know, here's a guy that thinks that we should have a living wage. And he talks about taking on the pharmaceutical companies and the healthcare industry. Yeah. I mean, I saw his speech when he was in Tampa a few weeks ago, and, you know, he sounded like a pretty far liberal.
Yeah, but that's another reason why he's not running as a Democrat or even going to run for governor as an independent. You know, he's not finished with the medical marijuana issue, and he's got this minimum wage issue coming up, which I think means a lot to him. Maybe down the road, those two issues could serve him well if he does decide to run again.
And Rita, in a matchup, if it is Gwen Graham, and if it's a matchup against Adam Putnam, tell us why you think Graham could beat Adam Putnam.
I think Gwen Graham is going to beat Adam Putnam, and I think she's going to beat them because I think Florida is ready for a change. And I think that we've seen a lot of suffering, and we're going to see a lot of change happen at this election cycle. Democrats are really sort of fired up, as you saw starting with the Women's March, and I think you'll see people come out to vote.
All right. Bill, what do you think? Matchup with Gwen Graham and Adam Putnam?
It's no contest. Adam wins this hands down.
I mean,
you go look at the polls. First of all, he's a fifth generation Floridian, Adam.
And so what is Gwen Graham?
Well, the thing is, Adam will cover, with the conservatives, he'll cover everything from Pensacola right over to Jacksonville. And he's known in the Bay Area. This kid went into the House, the youngest House member to go into the House of Representatives. When he was in Congress, he raised to the third-ranking United States congressman. He's a brilliant young man.
And how's that any different than Gwen Graham's credentials?
Well, I don't think she has the experience that he has. The House, Congress, much longer than a one term, 2 year, Gwen Graham, okay? And then being in part of the cabinet for 8 years, it's experience.
And she has spent an entire lifetime gaining her own, with her own political experience and her own set of accommodations and accolades. But what I think is really interesting is that we've got a new electorate here in the state of Florida. I would be doing voter registration with every plane that lands from Puerto Rico if I was in charge.
Well, we are heading into a new era, too, because we've got an influx of people from Puerto Rico. We've got 1,000 people moving to Florida every day, so there is some turnover in the electorate from 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 16 years ago. And we've got this issue of women and the treatment of women nationally that's really boiling over this year.
So I'm not sure experience is going to be what wins the race.
It might come down 18. To who plays better with independents, and I think I would give Gwen Graham a slight edge over Adam Putnam there.
Why would you give Graham an edge?
I just think she's more personable, a little bit more charisma, a little bit more likable.
Okay. Well, the influential senior organization, the AARP, is warning that the Republican tax plan would cut $25 billion for Medicare in 2018 and possibly more in the future.
The advocacy group for older Americans says the tax plan would add $1.5 trillion to the federal deficit over the next decade, prompting the pay-as-you-go law, commonly referred to as PAYGO, to kick in. That law was designed to keep the deficit in check by requiring spending cuts in many federal programs if Congress passes any measure that increases the deficit. Under PAYGO, if this tax bill were to become law, the government would have to cut $150 billion in spending every year for the next 10 years, according to the AARP. And that means that Medicare and other programs, such as the Federal Student Loan Program, agricultural subsidies, and the operations of the Customs and Border Patrol might be in the crosshairs. PAYGO caps how much the federal government can trim from Medicare at 4%, but even with that cap, that means a $25 billion cut the first year, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. And the annual Medicare cuts could increase in subsequent years, depending on the size of future deficits.
So, Kat, the AARP is saying this $25 billion in cuts to Medicare in the coming year after the if this tax bill goes all the way through. Is the AARP out on a limb, or are there other organizations that are agreeing with them?
No, they're not out on a limb. That $1.5 trillion figure is a CBO figure. So that is something that would happen. I mean, the Republicans are saying that this plan would essentially pay for itself by improving the economy and raising revenues. The Democrats aren't really buying that. But there is a real possibility that this would lead to the PAYGO provisions kicking in, which could mean a cut of that size for Medicare.
All right. So many people here in Florida are reliant on Medicare. How would that impact Florida?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a couple of things to think about. I mean, first, Congress would have the ability to override that. And Medicare is wildly popular. You know, senior citizens are a very important voting bloc, and it's a popular program among Dems and Republicans. So Congress could step in and say, we're not going to cut that. But if that cut were to go through, the thing to remember is that it would be a cut to the providers. So this isn't to say that that people would be booted from Medicare or that premiums would go up. Instead, what would happen would be the amount that the federal government reimburses the providers would go down. That could have some real effects. That could mean that some providers would stop being Medicare providers. We could see fewer Medicare doctors. Mm-hmm. Some providers could cut back on services. And that people would feel that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that people would be booted, or that premiums would spike.
Rita, Medicare, an important issue here in the state of Florida. Although, you know, I got to say that there hasn't been, to my liking, enough debate about this tax bill. There weren't hearings in Congress. I think a lot of the cable news TV shows have been preoccupied with other topics, haven't really given us a lot on the tax bill. The newspapers have been great. So if you read the papers every day, you're kind of up to speed. But boy, I think that other issues have kind of pushed this important issue off the front desk.
I think Floridians should be outraged over this tax plan. I think the whole Medicare issue should have them calling Marco Rubio's office nonstop. And you still have time to do that. And I think that Marco Rubio even came out to say publicly that although he's supporting the bill, which he should still be called on the carpet about, this is really about the first steps of eroding Medicare. And we in Florida, we are a Medicare community, and I think people should be taking action, and I think they shouldn't be distracted by their holiday parties and the other things, and they should be telling their elected officials, their senators, what they think.
Bill, is Marco Rubio, I saw him quote in a newspaper article the other day in which he says that we ought to look at entitlements. If we come up against these PAYGO limits, we ought to start cutting back on entitlements.
I saw the same thing, and I was with Marco a few months ago in Pinellas. But that's, you're basing this on the AARP, and I'll go with the stock market. Since Trump has been in office, we've gained almost $6 trillion in the market. That's some number. And when you have those kind of numbers, and the economy in the last two quarters is growing just about 3%, it was growing about 1.2 to 1.4 during the Obama administration. And it's expected to go to 4. If they can hold those numbers at 4, that money and the money that will be coming in from overseas when the companies repatriate over here will mean a lot as to what comes in and what the numbers will be. So the numbers are going to be all
over.
That
was a direct pivot from what we were talking about, which is this horrific tax cut and the effects of Medicare. So how the stock market is doing. No, it is. It is an absolute pivot. What you're talking about isn't relevant to the tax because
Go ahead.
Because it's not.
Well, Bill, you know, I do wonder, you know, will the Republicans, do you think, protect Medicare
Absolutely.
From cuts?
And yeah. they have in the past. I mean, these things have its ups and downs. And Florida is a Medicare state, and there's no question about that. They have to protect it. And there's a Republican majority in the Congress in Florida.
So I don't want to rely on Congress making a decision on whether or not we are adequately funding Medicare.
Bill, one other thing you said, how confident are you that these companies will repatriate their money once this tax bill goes through, their overseas profits?
Well, many of them will come in, and the blowback from that is people are saying, well, they're going to be buying back their shares, and they're going to reinvest in their own, and then the workers won't get as much. And to some extent, they're correct. But everything they put into the market and what they're doing is only strengthening up the pension funds, and it's only going to help people like Governor Cuomo in New York and Governor Brown in California because, you know, they're just about bankrupt.
Rita, how confident are you that these companies will repatriate their profits and those workers we see in the TV ads will get a raise? How confident are you?
I think that's a load of crap.
Okay. Well, the Florida Supreme Court has turned down Governor Rick Scott's attempt to remove Justice Barbara Perriente from an upcoming case deciding the future of the high court.
At stake is who has the power to name three new Florida Supreme Court justices on January 8, 2019. That's the day Governor Scott leaves office. It's also the last day for three of the court's more moderate members, Justices Perriente and Peggy Quince and Fred Lewis. Governor Scott says he has the power to appoint the new justices, even though he'll turn over power to a new governor hours before the justices retire at the end of the day on January 8th. And Governor Scott thinks Perriente has a bias, indicated by portions of a conversation recorded after oral arguments on November 1st. However, this week, the High Court disagreed, turning down his request to remove Perriente from the case. The case was brought by the Florida League of Women Voters, and the outcome could determine the ideological balance of the Florida Supreme Court for years to come.
So, Bill, these three justices are the more liberal members of the court, and so who should have the right to name their replacements?
Well, the governor of every state has the right to name the replacements on who goes on the bench, whether it's in the circuit court, county court, the judicial, the Second Court of Appeals, right up to the Supreme Court.
But if they're forced to step down because they've reached the mandatory retirement age, and that day is the same day that the new governor is inaugurated, should it be up to the new governor to appoint the new members?
It depends on the time frame, at what time they're sworn in. If Scott's got 2 minutes, it's his.
Okay, Rita, what do you think?
I think we have a process, and this should be about process, not about power. Why is Rick Scott feel that he's got the ability to remove them, you know, as he tried to do 2 years ago? Because he tried to remove the three liberal members of the bench. Now he wants to jerry-rig such that he's able to... It is a jerry-rig. We're going to go through an election. The winner of that election will be their right, due to the process, to be able to appoint the new judges. That's the way it is, and that's what should be held up.
Chris, this is tremendous power, whoever has this power. Three appointments to the Florida Supreme Court, this is a big deal.
Yeah, obviously it could tilt the ideological balance of the state Supreme Court. I just did want to make a point, though. It's kind of ironic that the Republican Party sees this as an issue when Scalia passed away on the Supreme Court, and Obama was blocked for 8 months from making a new appointment because he was a lame duck. I think it's something of a double standard there.
Well, you're talking about a national standard as opposed to a state standard, but I would bring in to the hot mic where Barbara and LaBarge are caught on a mic with some of the things that they were going to influence members of the judicial.
It was barely legible.
You didn't let me finish. I didn't
interrupt
you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Where it was barely audible.
It was barely audible.
It's in print already. It's out there. And I'm hoping that the Bar Association picks up on it, too, because I'd like to see them come out and take a stance against these justices,
but
liberal
Bill,
justices.
Bill, isn't it true that...
Why would they be taking a stance against liberal judges?
Because they shouldn't be commenting on...
Governor challenged Perriente, didn't challenge LaBarge. And both made comments.
Well, that's his prerogative, I guess.
It's okay. The power...
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Bill, let's start with you. Your other big story.
Okay. My other story is the Democrats and Republicans and what's going on in D.C. with the sex scandals and in both parties. It just got to end. And I don't think there's any excuses that each and every one of them in both parties should have their members resign, period. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Everybody should resign.
Exactly.
If they're accused?
Not if they're...
Found guilty.
Found guilty. Yeah.
The governor wants Jack Latvala to resign. Do you have an opinion about that? Should Latvala resign?
I'm not going to weigh in on Jack Latvala. I think that give the guy a break until we see what's happening.
Okay.
But that's where we are with that. And the other thing is, all those millions that have been tied up in this slush fund to protect these guys in Congress, no matter what party they're in or independent, I want to know who the names are, who paid for it, why the cover-up, and it shouldn't be with taxpayer dollars.
All right, Kat, your other big story.
I've got a sports story for you, Rob. The U is back. My Miami Hurricanes have a big game against Clemson. I'm predicting a big victory.
All right.
Go Canes.
Go Canes, all right. And Rita, your other big story.
I think the big story is Floridians should be paying a lot of attention to this tax plan, and they should be voicing their opinions, and they should be calling Marco Rubio and Bill Nelson with what they think should happen.
Is it too late, though, Rita? It is going to go to conference, but the House, I think, could just say, okay, we accept the Senate bill, and that would be it.
I think they should still be making their voices heard.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the biggest danger to Florida is beyond the question of Medicare that we do? That is the
Medicare is the big issue.
Yeah, okay.
Certainly we don't want to see the students lose their federal aid. I mean, there's a lot of other really important
things.
There's
tax deductions for graduate students that are going to be phased out.
Right, but yeah. I definitely think Florida should be concerned about the Medicare.
All right. Chris, your other big story.
Well, I'm going to make a plug for the industry that Kat and I work in. On Tuesday is the annual Love My Newspaper social media trend. Last year, it got 22 million people involved, and there were 39 million impressions on Facebook. So this Tuesday, people should tweet hashtag Love My Newspaper, maybe tweet a story that they think has showed the value of journalism.
You think newspapers are coming back?
I think with what we've seen today with the indictment of securities Flynn, you can obviously see
Michael
that
Flynn.
Yeah, the newspapers played a big role in uncovering some of that.
So they are coming back.
We matter.
All right. Thank you all for a great show, and thanks for watching Florida This Week.
That was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV in Tampa. And my guests on that program were Kathleen McCrory and Chris O'Donnell, both reporters at the Tampa Bay Times. Bill Bunting was the Republican on that panel, and Rita Ferrandino was the Democrat on that panel. One of the topics on Florida This Week was who has the power to appoint the next three Florida Supreme Court justices. Their terms expire on the same day when the new governor, is inaugurated in January 2019. And the question is, does the outgoing governor or does the incoming governor have that power? That's going to be the topic on Midpoint today, coming up at noon right here on WMNF with Sean Canan. Well, next we'll hear about the history of broadcasting in Florida. A new book called Towers in the Sand, for the first time, looks at the history of radio and TV stations in Florida. Newspapers leave behind a printed legacy, and it's easy, or much easier, to write a history about newspapers, but TV and radio is more ephemeral. There's no archive of local TV, film, and video going back to the early days of TV in the 1940s or the early days of radio in the 1920s. And most radio shows and news reports from the 95-year history of radio in Florida have been lost. There's no archive with a comprehensive collection. Our guest is Don Coley Jr. He's written the first comprehensive history of radio and TV in Florida. It's called Towers in the Sand. It's just been published. He'll be speaking in Tampa later this week. And Don, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Rob, thank you very much. I'm really, really pleased to be here. What a great introduction you just gave me. I mean, you summarized part of the problem of why it took me 12 years to write this book, because that record is not kept all in one place.
So it's an incredible book. It's quite detailed. How did you go about writing the history of all the basically all the major radio and TV stations in Florida, at least their early days, and some of the recent history too?
Well, I thought this was going to be a relatively easy process, because after all radio and television stations in the state are licensed by the federal government. So I thought, well, I'll just go to their website and be able to get all of the dates. Well, the records were not computerized until about the mid-1980s in terms of their accessibility. So I went back to broadcasting yearbooks back to the 1930s to be able to trace every station back to its roots. And that was really just the beginning, because Towers in the Sand is a story of broadcasting, but it's also a story of the people who made broadcasting stations, the interesting history of them, woven through the history of the state of Florida. So it's, you know, I tell people it's not a parade of call letters and frequencies. It's really human stories and social stories of the social history of our state. And your station has got some really, really interesting. You probably noticed a couple of pages in the book devoted to your station, including the interesting name of the licensee of your license holder.
Yeah, the WMNF, the licensee holders, Nathan B. Stubblefield, who was an inventor in Kentucky, who came up with a way to send signals through the air, which is something that Marconi came up with too, but Stubblefield should get some better credit for it, because he was doing the same thing Marconi was doing, although he was in the backwoods of Kentucky.
And nobody ever took him seriously about it, and unfortunately that kind of embittered him, at least from what I've read about his history. But when I was doing the research on the book, I remember coming across the name of your licensee. You guys were licensed in 1979, and I said, that's curious, and I started looking into it, and I think it kind of reflected the way I perceive your station, and Rob, I didn't get a chance to interview you for the book, but I did spend quite a bit of time with a really interesting guy, Bill Dudley, who I understand is still with your station, and just hearing about, you know, really kind of how the station started, and that you were looking to be an alternate voice or an alternative voice in the community. And I think it's just incredible that your station has managed to stay on the air, survive, overcome a lot of obstacles. And, you know, judging from the bit of the interview that I just heard on prior to getting connected with you, you guys are still covering big and important stories in the community, and that's what broadcasting should be about.
Yeah, for sure. Bill Dudley still hosts the Live Music Showcase, and he's got a show on our HD2 channel, the Music of the Isles show, which is covering Britain and Ireland music. Mostly folk music from those places. We're talking with Don Coley, Jr. He's written a new book called Towers in the Sand, The History of Florida Broadcasting. He'll be speaking at the History Center this week in Tampa. You'll be speaking this Thursday, is that right?
No, it's Wednesday evening. Coming Wednesday evening at 6:30 p.m. at the History Center, the Tampa Bay History Center. Admission is free, and I hope people will join us.
Donna, Tampa, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You go first.
Tampa is the site of the first licensed radio station in the state of Florida. WDAE AM signed on in 1922 and beat Jacksonville and Miami, both of whom were in the race to see which could be the first city with a radio station. And Tampa beat those other guys by a few days. And signed on the station, and that station is still operating today, although its call letters are WFLA today. I'm sorry, not WFLA, WF, forgive me, I just had a little mental block there on that one.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to have to look it up, because I forgot what DAE changed their call letters to. There was a connection. One of the newspapers was involved in getting WDAE on the air in 1922. Was that pretty common, where newspapers were trying to help radio stations get on the air?
Well, newspapers were among the earliest. In fact, the the station in Jacksonville that was in a race to be the first on the air was a station owned by the Jacksonville newspaper, the Times Union. And it did get on the air, although it did not get on the air prior to WDAE. And it folded only a few years, a short time later. So it did not succeed in that arena. But, you know, newspapers, I think, felt like, okay, well, this is kind of interesting. It's a way maybe to expand our audience, to get more advertising dollars. But in most cases, newspapers were not the real primary promoters of broadcasting back in the early days. In most cases, it was cities and developers that were seeking to capitalize on the Great Florida Land Boom. You remember in the mid-1920s, Florida was in the midst of a huge land boom. Yankees were coming down and buying property sight unseen, some of it swampland property and others. And so radio stations were envisioned to be this giant megaphone to lure people down to Florida and promote investment in the state, because in the 1920s, you know, the population was very low. Economy was not really strong in the state of Florida, and so it was seen as a way to really build communities. And so most of the stations that went on the air in those early days, their sole mission was building the cities and selling real estate and getting people to come down to the state from the north.
Yeah, because we just interviewed Craig Pittman about his book, Oh Florida, and he points out that in the late 1920s, I think it was the Miami Herald, was the thickest newspaper ever on record. It had so many pages because of all those real estate ads in the newspaper that land boom was. There were some honest brokers there, but there was a lot of dishonesty going on too back then in the 1920s during one of the great land rushes here in Florida.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the original Great Florida Land Rush in the mid 1920s. You know, people were buying real estate so fast they had what they called binder boys, which were guys that were just selling options on real estate for whatever. They would make their notes in these binders that they were carrying around, and it was a wild time. Now that all came to a screeching halt with a couple of things that happened: the hurricane of 1926, which was devastating for Southeast Florida, and then the followed 3 years later by the hurricane of 1928, and then that nasty thing called the Great Depression, and all of that stopped that Great Florida land boom and made it very, very difficult for the radio stations to survive and others, but they did in many cases.
We're talking with Don Coley about his new book, Towers in the Sand, The History of Florida Broadcasting. He'll be speaking at the History Center in downtown Tampa this Wednesday night at 6:30. Don, you start your book talking about a really fascinating part of Orlando history that I did not know, about the founding of a TV station in the late 1950s by a crusader that really changed the nature of Orlando. Let's talk about WLOF for a second. Tell us about the founding of WLOF-TV in Orlando.
WLOF-TV, which is now known as WFTV, as the call letters now, came on the air in Channel 9 in 1958. And the part owner of that station, who became the primary owner, was a man named Joe Breckner. Joe Breckner moved down from Maryland. He had been brought up in a racially integrated neighborhood in Maryland, and came down to Florida, and really was concerned about, when he got to late 1950s Orlando, seeing what he felt was a real injustice being done. The black community in Orlando, as in most southern cities, was segregated. I grew up in Orlando. I remember colored water fountains and all of those things that were remnants of that period of time. What he also saw, though, was that as integration, as cities began to try and figure out how to integrate lunch counters and become more open to all of their citizens, there were a lot of riots. There were some terrible things. Jacksonville had a thing called Axe Handle Saturday, where rooms of whites primarily were fighting with groups of blacks. And Joe saw this as something that was societally wrong. He felt morally wrong, and he thought it was bad for business, quite frankly. And he took that case to Orlando Mayor Bob Carr and said, you know, we need to do something about this before our city, too, explodes. So Breckner, with the mayor and others, formed an interracial committee. And Breckner took it upon himself and his television station self to really bring the issue of racial inequality to light through editorials, through hard-hitting news coverage, through documentaries and others, with the end result that Orlando successfully integrated its lunch counters, its motels, most of its businesses, very much earlier than many southern cities, and with very little difficulty in terms of racial violence and others. And I chose that story. It's called A Voice in the Wilderness, because I believe that that represents the true calling of broadcasting, to be community servants, to be part of their community, and to take stands on issues that are important to their communities. And so that story I thought was particularly illustrative of the important calling of broadcasters and the reason why broadcasters are licensed by the federal government to operate on public airwaves, which are owned by the citizens.
In the 1950s and early 1960s, as Joe Breckner and his TV station WLOF in Orlando were really campaigning to fight segregation, what about the Ku Klux Klan? What about racists in the community? Was the KKK there? And if so, was there pushback against what Breckner was trying to do in Orlando?
The KKK was definitely there. And quite frankly, the KKK was in most parts of Florida at that time. And they were not at all pleased with what Breckner was doing. The KKK put stickers on the building. There were bomb threats. And Breckner's approach to that was to invite the head of the KKK, of the national KKK, to be on the air and to debate these issues. And, of course, the guy did not show up. He did not accept the invitation. But Breckner, whenever there was a threat from the KKK, Breckner used that as another opportunity to go on the air and say, look what is happening to our community. We cannot let these masked crusaders intimidate, scare, and coerce people into doing what is not, or into not doing what is right for society, what is right for our community. So it was a very brave move, very brave stance that he took. Now, other broadcasters, other newspapers certainly did things too. But Breckner's story, which is pretty well documented in the book, I think really just was an illustration of what broadcasters can and should be doing for their communities.
WLOF eventually became WFTV. Did the Breckner family maintain ownership of what became WFTV?
No, they did not retain ownership. And that's an entirely different story, and it's tangential only to the work that they did for racial integration. But the what happened is it became a license challenge. You know, all broadcast stations are licensed by the federal government, and applications were competitive. and different groups could compete to try and get the license. And there were several competitors to the license, and there was also, unfortunately, involved an FCC commissioner, native Floridian named Richard A. Mack, who had a little bit of difficulty understanding the rules about, unfair influence and the way proceedings needed to be handled. And consequently, that tainted the license of Channel 9. And eventually, Brechner actually lost the right to operate the station.
Which is pretty rare. That's a pretty rare thing to happen.
It happened four times in the state of Florida, all connected with Richard Mack.
Wow.
Jacksonville, Miami, and Orlando, there were two in Jacksonville, two cases in Jacksonville, television licenses that were overturned. You know, back in those early days in the mid-1950s and early 60s, the Federal Communications Commission was just not equipped to handle what would become essentially multi-million dollar franchises that were being handed out, and the competition, the level of competition that came with those, they just weren't equipped to handle it the way the FCC was set up at that time. That story, which, by the way, became the longest-running license challenge in FCC history, is documented in my book as well about how that whole thing unfolded over, I'm going to say off the top of my head, more than 25 years worth of license challenge that thing went through the courts.
Wow.
But the bottom line was Brechner lost control of the radio station or the television station. And while he maintained some stock and financially, when the station was ultimately sold by the competing licensees, he did all right, but it was a personal blow to him because he had put so much of his personal integrity and personal drive and ambition behind that station and doing good work.
Was there a political motivation to try to remove Brechner, control of the license?
I think that there were a couple of things at play. One thing at play, quite frankly, was the stance that he took on racial integration. That was not completely accepted in the Orlando community. The other thing was the fact that Joe is Jewish, and I know that his wife, I interviewed Marion Brechner for the book. They felt that Orlando at the time was not very accepting of the idea that a Jewish man was operating a television station in that town in those days. Hard to believe these days that those kinds of things happened, but they certainly did, and that was probably one of the factors that went into that whole decision for various groups to come out so strongly against Brechner's ownership of the station and the license.
Well, we're talking with Don Coley, Jr. He'll be speaking at the Tampa Bay History Center this Wednesday night at 6:30 about his new book, Towers in the Sand, The History of Florida Broadcasting. Don is a seventh-generation Floridian. He was started off his career in broadcasting as a radio disc jockey. He eventually went into the Navy, and then later in his career was the manager of a CBS-owned affiliate in South Florida. Don, I just want to ask you one last question. We're down to the last minute.
Sure.
The importance of locally owned stations, those are disappearing, locally
Absolutely.
Owned. And so what's the impact on our communities here in Florida when you don't have local ownership?
Well, I think what happens is you can lose touch with your community. And from the station's perspective, they lose touch with the community if they simply become lines on corporate balance sheets, machines for generating money through the sale of advertising. And in too many cases, they lose that public service covering local news, covering events that are local, important to the local community. Many stations in most stations in your town and in
South Florida, where I live, are owned by big corporations, and most of them are parts of groups or conglomerate kind of clusters, they call them, of radio stations that no longer are connected to the community in the way that they used to be. The reason that that's bad is because we're losing our voices. We're losing public voices. You know, in your previous show, you were talking about the importance of local newspapers. And so many communities have lost their local newspapers now. So as we...
Don, I hate to do it, but we're out of time, and I'm so sorry. There's so many other stories I want to bring up, too. The book is Towers in the Sand, The History of Florida Broadcasting. Don Coley is the author. He'll be speaking at the History Center in downtown Tampa this Wednesday night at 6:30. Don, thank you so much for coming on WRMN.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, great. Thank you. And I know you understand the difficulties of the deadline here on these shows. Thanks, Don.
Absolutely.
This is WMNL.